Bobbig.
Hello everybody. Welcome to the talk of Ludwig Sundström about the essence of programming. Ludwig is consultant with InnoQ in Cologne, and he enjoys programming and talking about languages like Haskell, Clojure, Scala, and Erlang. Yeah, let's listen to him and enjoy his talk.
Hi everyone, can you hear me good? This is the essence of programming. Like, see so many people here, I'm really happy to be here. So, this is me. I'm a consultant, like I said, by InnoQ in Cologne. I am basically just a software developer. If you care about technology, just check out InnoQ. My colleagues do a lot of nice stuff with technology. So my agenda today is no crazy technological stuff. We have seen a lot of nice technology today, but today I want to take a step back and think about things that just interest me. And so what interests me is structuring, problem solving, and I want to see how we can use function composition in order to achieve that. And if I want to learn more about structure in problem solving, then I want to extract some ideas from a bit more formal ideas and see how we can use categories to learn about that. And most of all, so I want to talk about why these three things are actually the same. So structure, composition, and categories at some kind of abstract level. But let's put things into context. So this is me. This is my city. I'm from Stockholm in Sweden, you know, Venice of the North, very beautiful city. But most of all, I'm a programmer. I like to program in Haskell, Clojure, Scala, Erlang, and so on, you know, functional languages. So, and the reason for this is that I happened to go to this university, Uppsala, and I happened to have a course on functional programming as my first programming course. And I think a lot of things are like this in life, that you get introduced to something and you happen to like it, and then you carry on with justifying with that. So for me, it was functional love on the first sight, but it's like, it's also another example could be like a little child who goes with his father to a football game of some random team he doesn't really know, and just so happens becomes a supporter of that team for the rest of his life. But the thing about this talk is that it's not only about justifying functional programming. It's something more than that. But however, I continued with my newly found functional skills as hobby programmer in university, and I thought I was this creative genius with superpowers to rule the world. But and then, as with so many other people, I got out into the industry and I more identified with a picture like this. I had the withdrawal of this creativity that I found when I first got into problem solving. And the point is that our industrial environment is like a jungle. It has been said before. But in the industry, you don't have to really be creative. You have to maybe do things like getting Webpack to compile your latest JavaScript bundle in some new project configuration. Then you have to do another technical, very context-dependent bug until you have enough examples under your belt to finally be called a senior developer. So the point is that senior developers, they know how to avoid the bad parts of the jungle. They know, like, you have to avoid quick fixes, unnecessary layers of technology. And they know that, most important of all, you have to understand the problem. And it really comes down to this very basic thing, the problem solving the problem, which we talk about all the time in in software engineering, which is like we want to be able to modify one part of the system without breaking everything else. And today I want to give you, I don't want to solve this problem, but I want to give you some idea of how to approach this problem in like a more sane way. I would do this by explaining why functional programming matters. And I think that most of you already know this in this room, in this room, especially we know that pure stateless transformations in a more and more parallel, more and more chaotic world seems like a good idea. And the question we ask ourselves as functional proponents is, if functional programming matters, then why is our fan club so small, like relatively? And my take on this is that we are technical people. We have technical discussions and we learn to say things like, it depends, there is no silver bullet. And we learn that software engineering is about trade-offs. But most of all, we learn that to not touch what's broken. We learn to have faith in what we know, like what's already working. And this quote from Philip Wadler really summarizes this. And it's like, inspired me kind of to have this talk. And I think we should somehow break free from this mindset. So instead of having tunnel vision, justifying what we already know and getting lost in technical discussions, I think we should have an open mind and justify science and logic instead, and really start with the fundamentals of problem solving, because only if we do that, we can lift ourselves over this everyday programming grind that can seem so tedious to us sometimes. So why should we use functional programming to do this? Well, functional programming does not only matter, it's universal. We know that it has a direct correspondence with logic through the Curry-Howard isomorphism. And I believe in logic. I think it seems like a sane thing to do. So functional programming lets us talk about the structure of problem solving, and it lets us focus on the essence of programming. And I'll show you, I'll try to show you in this talk, why I think this is true and why this is true. So let's start with looking at the fundamentals of problem solving. Look at this tweet for a second. One programmer thought of a completely useless interaction, abstraction, and the second programmer sees this and becomes sad or angry or something. And the point is that just like Nick here, we are all reasoning about code. We all see the world, we all have ideas about it, and we do our best to create modular, loosely coupled, composable abstractions, not because we want to make this guy happy, but because we want to solve our problems. It's really a no-brainer. And the question is, how do we solve problems? Well, as every first-year university student know, there is a nice technique for this called divide and conquer. And it means that if you have a non-trivial problem, then what you do is that you split that problem up into sub-problems, you solve those sub-problems recursively, and then you compose everything back together again. And this is, in fact, the only way we as humans know how to solve problems. So seeing this like an elegant code, this thing that we talk so much about, elegant code, is just code that is easy to understand for us. And it's, in other words, it's code that is broken up into just big enough pieces for our brains to digest in an easy way. So it should be 7 or so pieces at the same time. And these pieces they kind of emerge through this divide and conquer process that we do. So as developers, we divide and conquer all the time. We split our systems into libraries, our libraries into modules, our modules into functions, and so on, and then we compose everything back together again, and we hope that it works. So I like to see a computer program like a solution to a problem, or also as a solution to many smaller problems, or complexity split up into pieces, or equivalently information flowing in the structure. This structure, as we have seen, it comes from our like process of dividing and conquering. And the question is now, how do we define information flow? So we define a unit of computation, or a unit to define this information flow, we call it function. And in mathematics, a function is a deterministic set of rules of how to map values from one set to another. And this is a very pure, this is a very understandable thing, this is a very pure thing, no fuss included. So in programming, we would like to use mathematical models of functions, but we cannot really do that because a running program has a notion of time that really doesn't exist in mathematics. But as we know, as we can get close enough, especially in languages like Haskell, that is designed with mathematical principles in mind. So let's think about our programs as a collection of pure functions composed together in a certain structure. And this is really the important thing. It's a structure that is important here. So we have that through divide and conquer, we get the structure, which we do as a programmers through function composition. So we have that function composition is the essence of programming. So now when we know that, we don't need to go away, because now I will talk about how to study the essence of programming. And you guess it, it's category theory. So we're going to make a shallow dive into category theory and look at the basics and try to maybe extract some ideas of how we can let us look at structure in our programs in a more clear way. But first of all, I want to take a detour into object-oriented land, where we have this book. It's Design Patterns by the Gang of Four. It's 23 patterns that you can use to make more clear, more robust, more flexible designs. Something like that, it says on the back. And in some contexts, it's really, really, really useful. But in the context that I'm talking about now, to put it bluntly, it's just a cherry-picked number of patterns that the authors happen to find. And I say that because category theory is like the science of patterns. So it likes, if you think about programming as a search space, big search space of patterns, then category theory lets us talk about, like discover and talk about these patterns in a formal way. It is a study of composition itself, which I will talk more about in a second. And it is a language that abstracts structure across different fields. So it started in mathematics, and mathematicians saw structure, like similarities in structure between different mathematical fields, and like mathematicians do, they abstract and they come up with category theory. So you really had to understand category theory in order, sorry, you really had to understand mathematics in order to understand category theory, and that makes it cool that you can apply it to something so pragmatic and down to earth as programming. Because why is that? As programmers, we don't want to do this. We don't want to talk about things like and then the next value or thing. We want to talk about interactions between things. And because programming is all about structure, interaction, that's why category theory applies well to programming. So show me what the category is. Category consists of objects and arrows. So the objects are just points in space. In here in this example is A, B, C, three objects. And the objects carry no other information than their own existence unless we give them some meaning. And the arrows are composable and associative interactions between these objects. And they also have no other meaning than that if we don't give them some meaning. So composable means that if you have an arrow between A and B and an arrow between B and C, like in a chain like this, and there has to exist a composite arrow called, we call it G after F, that does the same thing as those two arrows combined. And associative means that if we have like a chain of arrows and objects like this, then it doesn't really matter which way we, like which order we take these arrows. We can start with arrow F and then take the arrow H after G, or we can go first G after F and then take H, or we can take F and G then H. These interactions should mean the same thing in the category. And the last property is that every object has implicitly a identity arrow that is like the unit, in the same way as 1 is the unit of multiplication or 0 is the unit of addition. And it means that if we compose this unit with another arrow, it should not change the meaning of that of F. And if you compose ID of A with F, then it should not change. It's the same thing as F, and if you take F and you compose it with ID of B, then it's also the same thing as F. And that's it. And the cool thing about this is that category theory leaves it up to us to discover the meaning and to instantiate categories to our own needs. So let's see how to do that. So we define a category by saying four things. First, we need to say what the objects are, then we have to say what the arrows are, Then we have to say what the identities are and how the arrows compose. And this is an example, it's called it's a common example of a category. I call it M, but it's a monoid. I say that the objects of M is the single thing I call X. And I say that the arrows of M, which I denote with HOM M, is the natural numbers. And I say that one of those, okay, so the natural, so if I say in this example that the arrows are natural numbers, it means that this category with a single object has an infinite amount of arrows looping back to itself, and the arrows are labeled 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on up to infinity. And I choose one of those arrows to be called, to be the identity arrow, and this is the arrow 0. And I say that composition means addition in this little example category. And now I can check that this actually makes sense as a category. So remember, we have to have composition. So for any two arrows, we can pick any two arrows, L and M. There, of course, exists an arrow in this category called M plus M. So and composing those arrows does the same thing as that N plus M arrow. We can compose any arrow with the identity arrow, and that composition does the same thing as that arrow itself. And we have that addition is associative, so if we take two, if we have three arrows, we can take the first two, compose them, and then compose with the last one, or we can take the first one and then compose with the composed version of the last one. I think you get the point, it doesn't matter. The point actually is that all the logic is encoded in the composition in this. So it's a trivial structure, but it lets us talk about some kind of meaning just through composing things. But let's have a look, let's step back and look a bit in the programming context, because programming is great for building intuitions. So I think you would agree with me when I say programmers like data, and they like to give data types unless they are writing lambda and type lambda calculus or something, because they want to say what data means in a certain context. And they also spend their day, as we have seen, they spend their day in transforming this data using functions, and they compose those functions in order to not repeat themselves. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. We can have our own category called the category of types and functions, where the objects are types, the arrows are functions, composition is function composition, and the cool thing about this is that now we have a tool to study the essence of programming. So this category of types and functions, obviously huge, it contains all different types you can think of, all the different functions between these types, and these are just some of them. We have string, int, and bool, and we have some example interactions between these objects, length and even, and we can compose those interactions, of course. And as programmers, we can already get some intuitions from this category by seeing that if you have, for example, a string and take a length of it, and then you put that value somewhere, and then you check if that is even, that should be the same thing as checking if a string has even length. But maybe that's not enough, but in category theory, people like to do more crazy things. So let's shrink this category down into a single point in space, and that point becomes an object in like a new super category called cat. So in cat is a category, and its object are categories itself. And the arrows in this category are called functors. So the Germans seem to be really afraid of functors for some reason. They call them functors, and they like keep distance. But I promise you, functors are not dangerous at all. They're like mappings between categories, and they map objects to objects and arrows into arrows. But they're not like functions. Functions follow some rules, but functors have even more constraints. That they have to preserve the structure of the source category in the target category. And I like to think about that as meaning. So this is two example categories. The green one is the category of web pages and hyperlinks. And the blue one is the category of servers and service connections. And let's say that server A hosts all .com domain and server B hosts all .de domain. And a possible functor that describes this hosting would be this, would be depicted by the red arrows here. So the meaning of this mapping of these categories could be like if you press a link in the green category, does that mean that the new server rendered a page or something like that? And this is a valid functor because it preserves the structure of the green category and the blue category. And what that means is that if you take two objects in the source and check if there's an arrow between them, there should also be an arrow in the target category. And that should also be true under composition. So if you, for example, take this arrow in the green category, there is an arrow in the blue category, and then so on. And if you compose two arrows, for example, then the result of the composition should also be the same. This, for example, is not a valid functor because it tears up the structure of the source. And I think you can see that because if you put bass into server A and bar into server B, then and there's not really an arrow between server B and server A, which would be required. So this is not a valid functor. Let's have a look at functors in programming. So now the green and blue area are the same category. It's a category of types and functions that I was talking about before. And we can map between the same categories completely fine. And actually, that's all we do in programming. We're mapping between the same category if we're using functors. So a common thing to do if you, for example, have a string, if you, like you have any type, you could wrap it in a list. And this is commonly referred to as lifting a more simpler type to a richer type. So this is what we're doing here. And the question is, what should the interactions be on the top? Well, because we're using lists and because we're programmers, we usually use the function map to do that. But we really don't need functors and categories in order to know that we can map our lists. Like, I think we all know that. So let's get some more intuitions first. So a functor in category theory is a mapping between categories. But in programming, it's about constructing a richer type from a simpler type, and implicitly constructing richer function from simpler functions. So for example, if you have an int, you can make a list of it. And how do we do this in practice? In Haskell, there is a function called fmap. And this function represents a programmatic mapping between types and functions. It lifts simpler types into richer types, and it's represented by the functor class. So you have to implement fmap in order for your type to be a functor. This is the interface that you have to implement. It says that if little f is a functor, then give me a simple function from A to B where the types can be anything, like A can be anything, B can be anything, and then give me a richer type created from the functor based on A, and I will give you a richer type created from the functor based on B. But it's more intuitive to think about it like, give me a function from A to B, fmap will give you a function, a richer function based on the functor. So if you inline the definition of fmap in the categorical view, we see that we can just look at one of these interactions, A to B, and we see that the function, what it does is that it displaces this interaction into a new part of the category, whatever part would be described by this F. So this part could, for example, be the part that is described by lists. So if we have this nice structure of pure functions here, we shift it into a new area of our category, which is the area that is handled by list interactions. So a functor in category represents new parts of categories. And in programming, we can think about it as representing a new computational context, and this is where it starts to get cool. And it does so by preserving structure, this structure that is defined by preserving the properties of composition that I was talking about before. And with other words, this lets us focus on our original program structure, and we can put it into a new context. So, example context. We have already seen lists, where, just like before, we have these pure little functions, and these are functions that... So we have pure functions, and in the list context, these might have multiple return values. And another context is the concepts of maybe, like just like before, we're talking about pure functions, but these pure functions might fail. Or we have the context of I/O, where we have pure functions, we can execute them, but those executions might lead to side effects. And the point is, we should use the functor to abstract over these contexts. So, I'll just show you how to implement the functor interface for a list. So for a list, it's really just saying that fmap should be the same thing as map. So in Haskell, you would say you make list an instance of a functor by implementing fmap like this. For maybe in Haskell, you would say that if maybe is a functor, then fmap should be a mapping over just something should be that something applied to a function wrapped in a just, and mapping over nothing should be nothing. And IO is a functor if we can extract something from an action and return a new IO action with the function applied to it. So anyways, let's look at the and some command line examples. And the point here is that I highlighted my original program and I wrapped them in the context of a list in this example. Why list? Because list implements a functor, then I can execute my pure functions and I can trust that the functor knows how to deal with this context of a list. It does what I expect. The same structure I have, just wrapping it in a maybe. And I am exactly the same thing when I'm working in the context of I/O. I just have my original little program. I didn't change the structure. I just wrap it in this new context. So the point is, if you have some program, you have some structure, you have a functor that can take this structure and put it into a new context, and this structure is retained. And it's, of course, not only lists, maybe an I/O. We have in Haskell hundreds of instances of functors. So what you do as a Haskell developer is that first you learn these very basic abstractions, but very powerful. And then as you become experienced as a Haskell developer, you learn new instances of these. So thinking categorically gives us structure for free. In programming, we can do instant context switching. And in other words, gives us flexibility, code reuse, separation of concerns, all those things we ever wanted. And thinking back to this picture that I showed you in the beginning, I mean, thinking categorically will not make Webpack compile, but it will help us expose and think about structure in different ways. And like, it gives us a new view on context, like how to abstract over context. So, and it helps us to, well, it helps us in some regard to extend locally without complexing everything globally. And the functor is just the beginning. So for time reasons, I only had time to talk about functor, but there are many more powerful abstractions in languages like Haskell that focus on interactions and not the things themselves. So functor is a type class, and what it does is that it extends the behavior of data, but it doesn't touch the data itself. It's completely disjoint, and it's a part of a relation to other relations. So for example, applicative builds on functor, but it's not a part of a rigid type hierarchy. Its implementation is open, which means that you do not have to some bound. You can implement a instance for a functor for some data type that you didn't write, like much later. For example, it's not bound to the class that implements that interface. And it also helps documentation by giving us information about a function signature just by looking at the signature. You don't have to look inside the definition. That also comes back to this idea of looking at what the interaction is doing, not looking at the things themselves. So it does not require us to learn each context independently, because if you know that something is a functor, you know that you should be able to map over it. So it blends out the details and focuses on the interactions. That's basically what I want to say with this talk. So summary, fundamentally we only know of one way to solve problems, and that is splitting, solving, recursing, composing with this divide and conquer technique that we love so much. And structure, that is important for us in programming, it emerges through composition. How we compose these parts again that we solve, and we like to use pure mathematical relations to do this because complexing data with behavior really breaks this whole idea of focusing on fundamentals of problem solving. And category theory lets us study the composition, and it provides tools such as a functor that is really lets us think about structure in different ways than we would do in everyday programming. So, structurize and optimize. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this great talk. And yeah, there are still a few minutes left for questions.
Yes?
So what resource did you find useful to learn about category theory?
Sorry?
What are the resources that you found useful to learn about category theory?
So if anyone knows about Bartosz Milewski, he's the guy who's that I think started to introduce program category theory into programming. He has written a book called Category Theory for Programmers. He also did a lot of lectures on YouTube where talking about category theories for programmers specifically. And also just a month ago or something, he made with two other guys at MIT a lecture series that is also on YouTube talking about this stuff. And that is mainly it, but there's also other guys if you know Edward Kmet. He's a guy who basically reads a lot of mathematical papers and starts to implement libraries in Haskell just based on that. So he's the author behind Lenses in Haskell, for example. And there is also other great bloggers. Gabriel Gonzalez has blogged about category theory. I can just talk to me later if you want to know more. Yeah.
There is a sort of famous quote, but I forgot who's the originator. It says, "Category theory tells you which parts of your problem are trivial."
Okay.
Category
theory tells you which part of your problems are trivial. I'm not sure. What's your take on that? Or does anyone else in the audience have a take on that?
So,
yeah.
If you ask to be saved by the audience, my take on that would be that, in a sense, it's true that when you say, this we can see in the category theory, it's trivial in the sense that there was another way to see that does not require knowing about category theory. But also sometimes it's useful for killing designs that are not regular enough. So if you manage to use almost one of these trivial pieces from category theory, but not quite, then maybe if I change it that way, really looks brilliant in that sense, that's actually useful because it the word set of many different designs, it helps you select some of them with some ideas for where you prefer them visually to.
You know, from when you program in Haskell, like Haskell programmers, usually in my experience, they always want to, like, they don't care about readability. They just want to abstract as much as possible to writing point freestyle. Like, they are very satisfied when they can get this, like, everything in this point free style, and maybe like that's the realization when you have some spaghetti code and you can use these powerful abstractions to only be able to talk about interaction, because point freestyle in Haskell is just about interaction. So when you can do that, and maybe you can see, okay, this is a trivial part of my program, of my problem or program or whatever.
Some more questions?
I think for bigger data structures, there can be different implementations of a functor over it, or
yep.
Donut or something like mapping over a tree can mean different things. Is that not, or how is that solved? Or
There can probably be many implementations of a type class. You just have to choose. The functor has to apply some laws. I mean, this I have it here. So if you implement the functor, if you define your own data type, you can choose what it means in order to map over that data type. But it has to obey under these two laws that under there. So yeah, for example, you can have a monoid under, like, for integers under addition or under multiplication. So there are two different implementations. What's that?
Yeah. Well, partly. I thought maybe someone else has had one meaning in mind when you wrote some library or something, and then I will use it, and
yeah.
Maybe I have some other meaning in mind, and then
yeah.
Hopefully after a while I realize, like, that doesn't match or something. Does that happen, or?
Do you guys want to say anything to that, or do you have another? Okay, then go ahead.
Yeah, it happens all the time, actually. When you go back to the slide where you show all the function instances. There were some instances called max, min, sum, product, and so on. So it gives just different meaning to the same data. So it wraps step in a different way.
Exactly.
And saying, now I want the same data structure with the meaning of function composition to be that.
Yeah, so it's about also giving the giving the data types descriptive names. Yep.
I think maybe it's useful to point out that, I mean, it's useful maybe to think in category theory terms when you have, like, okay, this is functor in Haskell, and if I know what functor in category theory is, I can make the leap. But a functor in Haskell is not the same thing as a functor in category theory, because a functor in Haskell is a type class.
Still look at integers or pools, but we look at, for example, we look
look at rules in the context of conjunction or disjunction, and we look at
exceptions. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. Then thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.